Welcome to Heavy Networking, the flagship podcast from the Packet Pushers Podcast Network. If you admire EIGRP but are too embarrassed to talk about it in public, you found your tribe. I'm your host, Ethan Banks, along with Drew Conray Murray. You can connect with us both on LinkedIn and the Packet Pushers Community Slack group, and please do. On today's episode, we discuss securing GenAI applications with sponsor Palo Alto Networks. There's a couple of major categories that we are concerned about when discussing GenAI security. One category contains the third-party tools your users, and probably you, are using. So we're talking about OpenAI ChatGPT and Google's Notebook LLM, for example. Another category contains the GenAI apps your company is building internally. And we're past the point where it's acceptable to just let GenAI run and hope that it's all going to be okay. So how do bad actors look at GenAI attack vectors, and what are the attack surfaces, and how can you improve your GenAI security posture? To help us answer these questions is Rich Campagna, the SVP of Product for Network Security at Palo Alto Networks. Rich, welcome to Heavy Networking. Let's jump right into this topic. I want us to understand the risks of using GenAI. We're using the tools, but help us understand from like an application use perspective what's going on behind the scenes, and define those risks to an enterprise when their employees are using these third-party tools.
Yeah, great question, Ethan. I think as we all know, these tools have just kind of come out of nowhere in the last, let's say, 18 to 24 months. Most of this started with ChatGPT, but now we see tools in pretty much every category of business you can think of. It started with just standard generative AI. We see now marketing specific tools, sales specific tools, companion apps for things like video conferencing that really nicely and neatly summarize the meeting and put together action items for you. So these are incredibly powerful tools. And as a result, of course, we're seeing huge adoption across pretty much everyone in every function in an organization. So the starting point to your question is that this is could be a tremendous productivity gain for employees across the board, and is proving to do so. So largely, while there are risks, we're encouraging enterprises wherever possible that you have to find a way to allow these things for employees, because otherwise employees are going to try to find a way around controls. So when you think about these applications, I think there's a very familiar playbook for the typical enterprise, something they've gone through just in recent history, in let's say the last 10 years or so, which is shadow IT, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't too long ago that the use of applications like Google Drive or Box or Dropbox or other, third-party SaaS applications was viewed as something that's, a huge risk, typically adopted by employees first, not by the organization. And there was a huge frenzy. I remember probably in the 2012 timeframe, I helped start a startup in the cloud access security broker space, as it's now known. And, enterprises were completely up in arms. They run some of these initial assessments and find out that across their employee base, there were hundreds of SaaS applications in use that were not sanctioned or allowed by the IT organization. So in many ways, we have the same thing happening now. If you look at every major SaaS application, there are new AI components being added to those applications. And of course, there's brand new applications that are coming into the market as well. So in some sense, you have sort of this traditional shadow IT use case where we need to extend that playbook to cover some of the new risks. And I'll talk about that in a second, that some of these AI tools bring. And then in other cases, there are kind of a couple of new twists on that extension of that playbook that I think are important to some of the specific ways that an AI-powered application is different than a traditional SaaS application. And sometimes I think the easiest way to address this is to use a specific example as a starting point. I drive to and from our office here in Silicon Valley. I see a billboard for a company called Codeium, and they're trying to recruit engineers. They're probably trying to recruit our engineers. And so I've learned a little bit about Codeium. Codeium's a cool application. It's basically think of it as a code completion tool. But there's a couple of things that are interesting about Codeium. First thing is that it's absolutely free for a developer to use. Of course, there's an enterprise application or enterprise version, which is what they're trying to sell to the organizations. But for individual developers inside of an organization, they can go and use this tool free of charge. And it's got really powerful benefits, like a lot of other AI-powered coding tools, where it can go and will actually complete code or write code for you altogether. But what's particularly interesting about Codeium is that it mimics the semantics and the syntax and the standards of the code that's in use in your organization. That's incredibly powerful. So now as a developer, instead of some generic code coming back that I now have to modify to the specific sort of way that we develop inside of the organization, instead I submit code or submit a prompt to this thing and it brings me back code, but code that is already built to look like the way code inside of our organization is meant to look. Because it's a little bit different from one organization to the next because they have different syntax, they have different standards, et cetera. And so that's even more powerful for me because now as a developer, I'm able to get back and I can completely shortcut the whole code development process for whatever piece of the code that I'm working on. But as you may imagine, the way that Codeium does that is by learning from other code that's already been developed in my organization. It can only mimic our standards if I'm feeding it code already. And yeah. So you can see this is a free application, very powerful for a developer, but the only way to make it work the way it's intended to work is for code from my organization to go into that third-party tool, for that third-party tool to analyze that code, and then to return a response that is sort of somewhat similar to that. And so that's the kind of thing that we're typically looking at inside of an organization. Maybe the same thing for marketing materials, maybe the same thing for financial analysis.
Unique corporate intellectual property going that is used to train the model, you're saying?
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. Some obvious concerns, I think, come to mind there. The first one is this application, how safe is it? You know, the big question, Ethan, that people ask first off is the exact question you just implied, which is our data being used to train a model? Every information security team is concerned about that, and rightly so. They don't want sensitive data. Let's say that developer uploads some of that code and it contains hard-coded secrets, credentials of some sort. Hopefully that's not happening too much anymore, but it still happens every single day across thousands of organizations. I mean, that's a widespread challenge. But there's, in our kind of tracking in our database with these Gen AI tools, there's about 60 Gen AI specific attributes, including things like, does this thing train its models based on our data? And the idea is to help an organization understand all of the AI specific risks that are associated with this application. Now, there are also traditional risks as well. It's an application like any other application, but you want to understand things like, is this thing training the model? So that you can make an initial, let's call it a coarse grain decision on, do we want to block this application? Do we want to tolerate it, allow it to be a shadow AI application and allow that continue use? Or do we want to sanction it? Do we want to reach out to Codeium or whoever it may be and actually buy the enterprise license? So that's sort of, the first set of concerns are, what are the kind of security related attributes related to this particular application that are important?
The concern being the same concern I would have with any tool where I would pick up, again, my corporate intellectual property and put it somewhere. I have to know that however that's being consumed, wherever it's being stored, that it's got certain security parameters around it, that I can trust the company that I'm doing business with. There's data leak concern, there's compliance concerns. It doesn't sound wildly different from, I guess it's not uniquely a concern to AI in this case, but it's something we got to think about, right?
Yeah, and that's kind of why I started this on the track of this being an extension of this shadow IT use case. Now, there's some nuances and differences, right? The way that I, as a user, interact with a third-party Gen AI tool is different than the way I would interact with a normal kind of like whatever you want to call it, a forms-based web application, traditional SaaS type of application. So the framing or the input, what they call in the AI world, a prompt, is going to be different because I'm speaking in natural language or I'm typing in natural language or, maybe I'm submitting a visual of some sort.
Can I use the word bounded? So it, with a prompt, it would be unbounded, whereas with forms-based or something that would generate a SQL query, it's quite a bounded thing that I can sanitize that input. At a prompt, there's a whole thing about prompt engineering where I want to get really smart about how to pull data out of that thing by being really clever with the prompt I put in.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's an example of how bad actors are using these tools or attempting to subvert some of the controls built into these tools. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It's an unbounded type of input into the application. And so the way you have to look at or think about, in this case, what we're talking about is an employee accessing a third-party tool. And so when that employee's access, you want to think about, what's going in that prompt to the third party application, and that's where you want to do the data sanitization to remove things like those hard coded secrets out of that code, or next quarter's financial results out of some financial analysis engine that somebody's using. So, and then of course the other concern is what's coming back, right? So I send some code to some code optimization tool, and by definition, all of these applications are brand new in the last 18 to 24 months. And inside of those startups, they're moving as quickly as possible to innovate. And this is not to say that they don't have a focus on security, but security is not the top thing that their venture capital, investors are asking about, right? They're asking about customer traction, and you get customer traction by building features that are enticing to the user. And in this case, it's a user that isn't necessarily going through the whole compliance vetting process, going through legal governance, all these. It's an end user that says, hey, I want to get my job done faster. I want to write this blog post, and I want to do it in 2 minutes and not 2 hours. And so, the challenge there is that you don't know, the models could come from anywhere. It could be their own custom developed model, but maybe they're training on external data. It could be an open source model we found over 100 malicious models out there in the wild in our research team already. And we're just, we're just getting starting in this AI revolution out there. So there will be more.
I understand, it's not good to have sensitive information going up into, a cloud that you don't have a lot of control over. But what is the actual risk that it could somehow leak back out based on some kind of malicious or tricky prompt or just inadvertently? What is the actual risk?
Well, actual risk could take a couple of forms. So first of all, I may disagree with you a little bit, Drew. You said you agree that it's not good to have sensitive data going up to a third-party service. Sometimes it is a good thing, and you want it, right? Like in that Codename example, I want to have the response come back and be, even if I'm a security person, it's a good thing for the organization, for my development team to be more efficient. Uh-huh. Right. So I'm going to partially kind of disagree with you there a little bit, yeah. But what are the risks? So first of all, if data is being used to train a model, that's a big concern. Right. So in that, we'll continue on this coding example. Hopefully I'll get creative and we'll switch to a different example at some point in this discussion. But let's say it's code, right? I have source code. It contains intellectual property. Probably the vast majority of my code is not necessarily sensitive, but certainly there's some areas of my overall base of source code that contain my organization's intellectual property. And it may contain things that are maybe even customer specific, certainly things like I mentioned before, credentials, hard coded in that code, et cetera. So what does it mean to train a model on a piece of data? Well, it means that the model is ingesting that data. Let's say in this case, it's our source code. It's learning from that. And it may take those things, that data that it's learned and use that in a response to another client, right? And so this is data being used to train a model. That goes into the kind of the base of the model as the model evolves over time. And that could potentially be exposed to another organization. And this is where something like an intellectual property concern would come in, as opposed to a RAG or inferencing type of model where inferencing type of input where I put something in that's specific to me. It's not being used to train or to tune the model, but instead it's just being used to, augment the response that is coming back to me. And so that's less of a concern than the data actually going in and training the model and then potentially being available to others as well. So that's just one concern. And forget, I think Ethan mentioned before compliance, all kinds of compliance concerns. We don't know where this data is being hosted if it's a third-party model that's not, sort of sanctioned by the organization. We don't know controls. I mean, even just that data, if it contains, let's say, some customer-specific information goes up into that cloud, that's a compliance violation for some organizations just by nature of the fact that it's gone to that third party. So various different concerns there, Drew.
Rich, can I get a point of clarification about how models are trained? Because when I think of a typical SaaS software instance, I think of it as my own. They cut out a replica and all my data is housed in a unique instance. It's not shared with anybody. It's mine. They're just holding on to it for me in the cloud. But the way you made that sound, it's like my data could get mashed into a model that's got data from a bunch of other organizations as well. And the model's kind of being trained on a common data set, or it's making it into a common data set shared by a whole bunch of other companies. Is that right?
It could be. It depends on the the application provider that you're working with. It may not be in a lot of cases. So, and I'm not trying to be evasive on the answer to there. There are definitely, pretty much anyone that's selling to the enterprise, this is like concern number one. And so they're going to train on other data sets that they have available to them. They're not going to necessarily train on customer specific data. Now they may do some fine tuning in a customer, let's say a customer tenant, but then isolate that fine tuning just to that tenant. So there's different ranges here, but if we're talking about an application that, Joe employee can go and use, there is the potential for an application to be training the models on that data that's coming from, and that's something the organization needs to know about ahead of time, right? If I go and buy, one of the big things, even something like Codeium, enterprise version of Codeium, right? It's not going to take my enterprise's source code and then use it to train its models and then potentially have my data mixed up into responses from other organizations. There are definitely controls in place in sort of these enterprise applications, but a lot of what we've talked about thus far is called a consumer or an employee accessing an application on their own outside of those enterprise controls. And you don't know whether or not that's a concern unless you're vetting these things ahead of time.
And there's an incentive. If I'm an AI toolmaker, I want my model to be amazing. And so the more data I have to throw at the model, the better my responses are going to be, the better my tool can do its job. And so there actually is a potential reason for them to just want as much data as they can get from everybody to make the model, to turn it into a better product that they're selling to everybody.
Data is the thing. That's the end game here. If you get your hands on the right data set, go create your AI application company, whatever it is, because that's absolutely the key to training these things and providing a high quality response.
Well, okay. So we've talked about the risks to an enterprise when employees are just using Gen AI tools. I thought that was going to be a fast answer. That was not, because this went much deeper and down different holes than I was expecting. Well, let's look at a different sort of risk, which is I'm an enterprise building a Gen AI tool of my own. What risks is that introducing to the organization?
To me, at least, equally fascinating, because you start by looking at what's happening in the typical enterprise, and it doesn't even matter the industry. You know, I talk to customers, a couple customers at least a day, and in almost all cases, they have the same situation. Their CEO or some whatever high-ranking executive on the top floor in the big office has a bug around AI, and they're pushing these things aggressively, right? And it kind of falls into two categories. One is they're pushing development of some AI-powered applications because it can help give them a competitive edge and help build the top line by accelerating the business. Or, and this is especially true in customer service kind of oriented types of industries, they want to kind of change up the customer interaction to build some efficiencies to help them improve the bottom line, right? So these applications have a direct path to either the top line or the bottom line of the business. And so, of course, they're being pushed by the business as aggressively as possible. So what does that mean for the organization? It means that incomprehensibly short timelines are being pushed, and you got to get something out as quickly as possible. And so if you're a developer, what are you going to do? Well, you're going to go out and you're going to source as much of that kind of the components of this as possible and rush something into production. And it's interesting. I talk to a lot of organizations that will say that, hey, we're just using, something like Google or the like Bedrock from AWS as an example, right? And so think of this as a walled garden. These tools from these major cloud service providers that most organizations are already aligned to one or more of them. They're already customers. You'll go to something like Bedrock, and it's got AWS's first party tools. And then it's got some well-known open source and then third-party commercial tools. So it may have something like Claude from Anthropic. It's a big kind of popular commercial tool that's available in these walled gardens. You may have Llama from Meta, which is an open source tool, right? So this is kind of this tightly controlled environment of models, these foundation models that are available through those tools. And then another set of, kind of things like guardrails built around use of those tools and around how data kind of makes its way into those tools, either for kind of fine tuning those foundation models or for inferencing or pulling data in. So there's some set of controls there, but maybe those things are not appropriately tuned to the needs of my organization. So let me ask you guys a question. Have you heard of something called Hugging Face?
Yes.
Yes.
You have. Okay. Maybe not all of your listeners have. So maybe I'll just a quick. So Hugging Face, it sounds like it's a chatbot for teenagers. And that's exactly how it started.
That actually sounds like the face hugger from Alien to me, but it's a different reference point.
It's supposed to be that Hugging Face emoji. I don't know how to describe the Hugging Face emoji, but just look it up. So these two guys, they started a chatbot for teenagers application. And in the course of developing it, they came up with an AI model to drive this thing. Well, the chatbot never ended up taking off, but sometime during the course of development, they open sourced this AI model. And that really started to get a lot of traction, a lot of use. And so they, like a lot of startups do, they pivoted. They pulled the famous Silicon Valley pivot. And now the Hugging Face is a platform for developing, hosting, and kind of running models and data sets for AI specific applications. And I see this in use in some of the largest financial services organizations in the world as an example. It's because it's got some compelling benefits. So instead of these 3 to 5 models that are made available for developers and something like Bedrock or Gemini from Google Cloud, we have there's over 1 million models in Hugging Face. I looked this morning. And there's over 221,000 data sets. And so oftentimes these are already kind of pre-tuned and trained for specific needs. And so I gave a talk to a bunch of CISOs in the healthcare space last week. And ahead of that talk, I went into Hugging Face and I just said, let me just kind of find, some models and data sets that their developers might use out of this thing, to make things available. So I found one called, MetaLlama. Right. So MetaLlama is Facebook, is the Meta kind of open source tool. So MetaLlama is basically it's a version of Llama that is already pre kind of fine tuned around some medical use cases. And specifically what it is meant to be, it's a model that helps you develop an application that allows your healthcare providers, your doctors, nurses, et cetera, to do things like diagnose symptoms, suggested treatments and medications and these kind of things as you're having an online discussion, like a video discussion with a patient, so, which sounds crazy to me, but hey, it's a new world, right? Yeah. So the way this would work, I would build an application that uses this model. And as I'm talking to the patient online on the Zoom, the online discussion, this thing is listening to this discussion, which alone the HIPAA concerns kind of start to become a big challenge, listening to discussion and then kind of diagnosing the symptoms that it's hearing and giving this to the healthcare provider so they can pair it back to the patient. So hey, that's compelling. If I'm being tasked to provide to build an application like that, why would I go to the work and find the data sets to fine-tune this thing? So I dug a little bit deeper in MetaLlama. What's it trained on? Well, there's another data set available in Hugging Face, which basically has hundreds of thousands of transcriptions of discussions between doctors and patients, right? So you take a model like this, you train it on this data set that who knows where it came from, who knows how many, sensitive kind of patient information is available in there. And now all of a sudden, hey, you got something of questionable provenance. You don't necessarily know where it's come from or what exactly it's been trained on, but you've short-circuited your development process by months, right? So this is kind of like one of the big concerns is we're getting these components. All the open source world for this stuff is pretty much brand new. You pull in this data, you pull in these models, it may help move things more quickly to meet the business need, but a lot of security concerns come up both in the supply chain, which is what is the training data? Should we even have our hands on the training data? Where's the model come from? What else has it been trained on? Combined with the fact that because you don't know, really all the full strength and testing of that model, a lot of runtime concerns as well. Ethan, you mentioned prompt engineering before. Something like ChatGPT or Llama as an example. I mean, they've been put through their paces. They're actively heavily developed, and they're putting some of the controls in place against things like prompt engineering. But these other tools, who knows, right? So this is kind of part of the problem. It's an opportunity and a problem at the same time, just with the shadow IT use case, which is that, things are trying to move quickly. It has tremendous benefits for these organizations, but you have these components coming in that are really hard to vet and get a handle on because they're not well known and proven out there like some of the big open source projects we see in the traditional application development space.
I mean, in some ways, it feels like we're going through all of the problems we've gone through in cloud and shadow IT and open source software, but we're just doing it again at a much faster pace now.
Yeah. And by the way, this happens with every generation. I was thinking about the other day when the iPhone came out. So I don't know how old the typical listener is, but I was working on SSL VPNs at a major tech company when the iPhone came out, and, you know, carrying my BlackBerry, if you guys remember those. Mm-hmm. And when the iPhone first came out, I think in 2007, and at the time, everyone thought, okay, this is a consumer tool. It's like an iPod. It makes phone calls, but it's never going to make its way to the enterprise. And at first it didn't. And then something interesting happened. What happened was that the iPhone got ActiveSync support, right? And that completely overnight changed the game. I remember working at this tech company. I think we had like 7,000-8,000 employees at the time. And as soon as I think iOS 3.0 came out, which had ActiveSync in maybe 2008 or 2009, every executive in my company went out and got an iPhone. And so what did the IT team do? The IT team went and they shut down ActiveSync on all the Exchange servers. But they forgot there was one Exchange server in Hong Kong at this company I was working at that was left. ActiveSync was left on. It was just a miss in the configuration. And slowly but surely, word got around about this thing. And then, you know, before you know it, everyone in the cafeteria, everyone was carrying an iPhone, right? And they were all doing the same thing, hitting this ActiveSync server. There were thousands of phones hitting this ActiveSync. And this is what happened in every single enterprise. And so this was the very first time that sort of consumer technology really made its way in. And then, of course, we saw SaaS and like cloud had some similarities, you know, in the early days. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, here. And so with each, you know, subsequent generation, things move faster. But ultimately, it ends up typically at the same thing, which is what I think is going to happen with AI, which is there's a lot of fear and uncertainty at first in InfoSec teams because this stuff is just thrown at them with no notice. But then ultimately, it turns into a set of tools that are, you know, appropriately controlled and incredibly beneficial to organizations. And, you know, I think that's the positive here. There's always some kind of this scary, frantic time up front for information security folks, which is hard. I feel bad about that. But of course, you know, my organization is developing tools to help kind of take some of that fear away and allow them to, you know, to get their arms around this thing. But there's always some uncertainty at first. And yes, Drew, to your point, this is moving faster than anything we've ever seen.
I mean, I guess my larger point, though, is that I'm trying to work out a metaphor here, but the actual landscape may be slightly different, but we've been to this territory before. The map is the same. The sort of risk profiles are very similar. So it's not, if you are sort of feeling overwhelmed, you just have to sort of reorient your thinking like, oh yeah, we have been through this before and we kind of have tools in place to address this, which we'll get into. But I just want to, so we've talked about the risks of the enterprise for employees using third-party Gen AI tools, the risks of enterprise building their own Gen AI tools. What about the risks of outside actors using Gen AI tools to their advantage, either attacking Gen AI tools that other companies using or using Gen AI to develop more capable attacks? What are we looking at there?
Well, attackers are smart, just like employees are. So there's, you know,
they also need to be more productive. As
they've been using the cloud to scale up distributed denial of service attacks for years. Yeah, they need to be more productive. So of course, you know, that kind of thing is happening. So and interestingly, in that space, well, a couple of things. The first and foremost, and this should have died long ago, but the days of you know, improperly formatted or grammatical and, you know, lots of spelling mistake phishing emails are out the window. You know, at the very least,
they're getting so much better. Seriously, there was one I saw. I could have sworn it came from a financial provider. It looked right on the money because it was a financial provider I was familiar with. And I dug in and started looking at the links and it was like, oh, this is a phishing attack. Wow. They've gotten good. They've gotten really good.
They have. So if you're an attacker and you're out there listening and you're not using these things, then you find another career, right? So and actually what we see in our data is more than a 30% increase in the success of phishing attacks, email-based phishing attacks, when the email is written or rewritten by one of these Gen AI platforms. So that even just right off the bat, amazing productivity gains as a hacker, you know, just by rewording your initial infiltration, you know, whatever you're landing is, whether it's an email or a website or what have you. But then interestingly, even a lot of the tools in use by the enterprise, by red teams and the like, are being used by attackers as well. And you know, you look at something like PowerShell Empire or Cobalt Strike or some of these types of tools. These are red team tools that are adopted by major enterprises to, and they're specifically built to, you know, to vary things like command and control, communications, and other types of aspects of attacks to evade defenses, right? Mm-hmm. That's what these things are built for. And what we end up seeing is a higher and higher percentage. Well, first of all, what we end up seeing is attackers getting their hands on those tools because they're very powerful. They work for red teams. They should work for attackers as well. Not that there's anything wrong with those tools. It's just as they've gotten more powerful and leverage more of these AI-based components, attackers continue to adopt those things. And what we end up seeing is a dramatic rise in the number of new and unique attacks that we see out there every single day. So we're seeing something like 12 to 13 million attacks every single day that may use a common technique, but are they have some variant, some difference than any other attack. So that's triggered as a new attack that has never been seen before. 12, mm-hmm. And that's just across our customer base. And certainly there's, you know, I mean, we have decent market share out there in the industry, but there's a lot of other firewall vendors out there, you know, selling as well. So just 12 million just in our customer base every single day. And that's a dramatic rise from just a couple of years back. And the underlying cause of that additional sort of sophistication and volume of attacks is that these tools now give even novice attackers some of the capabilities that even 5 years ago were kind of the domain of the nation state, right? Like, you know, people exploiting new zero days or being able to kind of, you know, morph and change their attacks. And so this is a very real concern for the enterprise. It certainly caused us to change a lot of our strategy in terms of how we develop products. But that's it. If I can go out there and with just a couple of clicks, create something that never has been seen before and is going to dramatically improve the chances that it's going to infiltrate maybe some sort of perimeter security or other sort of security mechanism out there, I'm certainly going to use it, and they are using it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Rich, what would be an AI security framework then? We've really framed a lot of the challenges and what AI, Gen AI as a technology is introducing here that's kind of different, makes us think a little bit differently. So what's a framework that I would put in place to think about defending against these sort of attacks?
So I think we've talked about a couple of different scenarios thus far in the discussion. I think each of these scenarios requires some sort of a framework or an approach, right? And so if we think back to the beginning of the discussion, we talked about employees accessing third-party tools. It's pretty simple. I think, Drew, as you mentioned, this is an extension of scenarios and playbooks we've seen before around shadow IT. And largely we follow the same thing. The first thing we need to do that employees are using these tools, that right off the bat, you know, at least half of your employees are using some sort of tool in their day-to-day working life. So the starting point there is understand what's in use, right? Categorizing, understanding both the traditional risks as well as some of the Gen AI specific risks, such as the you know, training the model on the data aspect that we talked about before. Understand that and then make a decision either categorically or on an app by app basis of, do we want to block this thing? Do we want to, put up with it, put up with the employee using it on their own, or do we want to sanction it and buy the enterprise version or do something like maybe it's a third party code development tool and we want to enforce the standard, which is, you know, GitHub Copilot, right? And so there we're going to redirect users into something like GitHub Copilot. So that first thing, let's call it access control. Uh-huh. Decide whether you want to allow it or not based on some risk assessment, and then put the sort of coarse grain controls in place. And then, of course, you want to do things like inspect what's going into the prompt, look for sensitive data. Like,
yeah, okay. Well, that's not all or nothing then. It's not. I mean, I can't have an all or nothing. Do I want user X to have access to this tool at all? And then if they do have access, then I want to inspect their prompts and make sure that we're kind of like a web application firewall. I want to control the input by, you know, sanitizing what's going in there.
Absolutely. And then as well, sanitizing the response, because a lot of these tools are new. You know, you don't know if that model's been compromised. And if I put some, you know, code up into a third-party tool to be optimized, you know, perhaps it's coming back with a malicious script, or maybe there's some embedded URL or domain, which is malicious as well. That's a possibility. And we've seen that in the wild. It's perhaps not super widespread with a major tool, but it's certainly a possibility. So you want to be sanitizing both the input and the response from the tool.
But there's a challenge here with categorization of the tools, maybe. In other words, if I want to block AI tools as a category, it's not like it runs over a specific protocol. It's running over HTTPS very probably. It's going to look like a web app. So how do I mean, is there categorization going on where I can check a box because somebody at Palo Networks or somebody's trying to track all these things that are popping up all over the internet?
Yes, the answer is yes, we certainly do that. So right now, let's say in our, we have this, there's kind of two levels of classification in our product. We have this thing called App ID, which is kind of the foundation of where Palo Alto Networks kind of began, which is just identifying across all this HTTPS and other protocol traffic, specific applications. There's tens of thousands of applications there. And then there's the URL filtering database, which is, you know, millions of domains and the like. So specific, one of the things that we've done, and let's say we shipped this product, I think in August of 2024, is we've gone out and the initial product had about 600 Gen AI applications in it. And so there's a set of risk-related attributes for traditional application. All of those applications need to be vetted across those attributes. And then, as I think I mentioned before, there's about 60 additional Gen AI specific attributes that apply when it's one of these AI tools or when it's an AI extension of an existing kind of traditional tool, those attributes. And so those are all tracked by a combination of obviously a lot of automation. So we're 600 when we launched, we're moving to 2,400 here in the very near future of app Gen AI kind of categorization of applications. And of course, those are broken down into further subcomponents, because I think AI is just too broad, right? Every application has some AI component. And so it's like code development and optimization tools. It's marketing tools, you know, financial analysis tools with AI components as well. And that's kind of where you want to make some of those access control types of decisions, is more at that level of categorization. But yeah, we're doing that hard work so our customers don't have to, right?
So just as I, as an administrator, wouldn't have to keep track of every online, you know, file storage platform out there, I could just click a category box. You're trying to do the same thing for AI applications.
Exactly. All these software development applications, anything in that category with a medium or higher risk level, and redirect those users to our internally sanctioned version of a similar type of tool is the basic idea.
Okay. So I can block all and then write in my exceptions as needed.
Absolutely.
So going back to our earlier part of our discussion, this was the first part. Users who are interacting with third-party Gen AI tools, we've got some controls that we can put in place there. Are there also, in the context of our framework, our approach to this, do we also have tooling we put in place for the development of Gen AI tools we might be doing internally?
Absolutely. Yeah. So that was kind of the second use case. So we started with employees accessing external applications. Now it's the opposite, right? Internal application, perhaps it's employee tool, but maybe it's for end customers, you know, depending on the industry and the use case. And so now the application is inside the organization. They're sourcing all those components, things like the training data, the models themselves. We talked about that MedLlama in Hugging Face kind of model a few minutes ago. So here, two stages, each of which are, you know, somewhat have a couple of subcomponents. The first one is just the supply chain, right? Just like the software supply chain, it's become a very big topic for a lot of organizations in the last couple of years, starting with, if you remember the SolarWinds incident from a couple of years back, people started to take a much closer look at their supply chain. Where is this? Where are the models, but all the other application components as well, coming from in terms of open source? You know, are they, you know, scanning and analyzing for vulnerabilities, ensuring that the appropriate, you know, sort of permissions models are put in place in and around all those components, microservices inside of an application, you know, kind of traditional application development kind of stuff, but then also controls around that model, which is the new component, right? And so if you take a step back, AI applications, it's a traditional application, but it's just got just a couple of new pieces, right? So it's all the same application security kind of stuff that we need to focus on with a traditional app. We also, a Gen AI app, it's a front-end application. The model may be backing this thing up instead of some other component, but it's got the same risks associated with it that need to be mitigated in terms of outside access, outside attackers trying to go after this thing. So it's a classic application plus. And the plus part is the model and then some of these new forms of data, maybe the same data, but new ways that data makes its way into those things. So protected on the front end, like a traditional application, protect or look at the provenance of the model. Where did it come from? Does it have vulnerabilities in it? And then the data set as well. Are there appropriate controls around the data set? If we're training on external, let's say publicly available internet facing data, we've seen the first attacks now where people actually will poison that training data from the outside and then use that with the understanding that the model is going to train itself on that poison data. And then now you have a different form of sort of like an indirect prompt engineering kind of attack where you've trained this thing to respond in a certain way to a certain type of prompt, maybe to provide a malicious response. So anyway, the training data becomes important, putting controls around that. So that's your supply chain starting point number one, focused on the model and the data, in addition to traditional application security for the application, was the front end application. And then the second piece is the runtime. Right now, this thing is running. And it's once again, the opposite of the employee accessing the third party use case. Now you have potentially sensitive data in your model that the application has access to, and you have an attacker on the outside trying to use the prompt to pull that data out. So instead of, you're trying to stop the outside person from pulling data out instead of the inside person from pushing data out of the organization. Similar kind of thing. You want to scan and sanitize if that's a new application, hasn't really been fully vetted against something like a prompt injection or something along those lines. You want to ensure that sensitive data in that rush development isn't making its way outside of the organization. And you also want to stop that attacker from doing some of those prompt injection or prompt engineering types of techniques. Denial of service attacks against the model may take a different form where it's just trying to hammer the model with a different sort of form of input. So there's a number of kind of these runtime attacks that are also happening as well. So those are two components, supply chain and runtime. Supply chain is typically in your development process, scanning the data, the model, and other components. And then the runtime is, inline controls, either a network-based control or probably more commonly an API-based control that's actually, in the middle of between the application and the model, and then perhaps the model and the data sets themselves, and putting controls in place to stop suspicious or unwanted activity.
This notion of supply chain risk, do you anticipate the use of models maybe starting to be added to things like SBOM, Software Bill of Materials, or is that not the right place for it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's another application component like anything else that becomes the core brain of some of these applications. So, and it's coming from, very few organizations are out there building their own models. Right. Some of the options you hear about the big ones. Right. But, for the most part, they're sourcing these things from their existing cloud service providers that they're working with, AWS, Azure, Google, or they're out there in the open source world trying to source these models from somewhere like Hugging Face or, wherever those models may be available. So it is absolutely a component of the software bill of materials. A model can have vulnerabilities just like anything else. We talked about prompt engineering vulnerabilities. That's the most obvious one that people talk about. Maybe trained on malicious data. So yeah, you have to, absolutely, that is part of your software bill of materials and something that needs to be risk mitigated when building it into those apps.
Now, Rich, you've mentioned that Palo Alto Networks has tooling for this, so that the framework that you just described, the approach, the way to think about how to defend against these attacks, mitigate these attacks, I need the tools. Palo Alto Networks has, you're calling it secure AI by design. There's three components to it, as I understand it. We've got AI access security, AI runtime security, and then Prisma Cloud AI security posture management, which is helping us deal with supply chain. Walk us through what that is. Is this something I have if I'm a Palo Alto Networks firewall customer, let's say? Is this something I'm buying that's a cloud service? What is it?
Largely what we're doing in this space is extending existing products. I mean, part of what I just talked to is the fact that these AI powered applications also have a lot of the same sort of traditional concerns, right? So for us, it makes a lot of sense. We're investing very heavily in this area, but these foundational attacks against an application or foundational shadow IT concerns also apply in this space. So you kind of need both. You can't just go in and say, we're going after the AI use case. And just building this and let some other security provider deal with some of the foundational attacks or foundational risks. So what AI access security does, it talks about our first use case that we discussed early on, employees accessing third-party applications. So, and I mentioned this, Ethan, we talked through this database of hundreds of Gen AI applications. We're doing the hard work through automation and through our threat research team to analyze and assess the risk of those applications across all these dozens of attributes, and then putting the controls in place to understand and interpret the prompt to prohibit data from leaking from the organization. And then the response, sanitizing those responses against largely a lot of our pre-existing threat related, it's scanning for malware, scanning for malicious scripts, other types of things in the responses. So that's AI access security.
So just a quick on how that's delivered. Is that an agent on an endpoint that's able to see that traffic before it's decrypted? Or is there a man in the middle there that is able to decrypt, see what's going on, re-encrypt and send it on?
Yes. all of it. So across our network security portfolio, we have a number of different, what we somewhat uncreatively call form factors, right? We have firewalls. These are inline devices. We have SASE, which is, think of this as a cloud delivered proxy inline device, which may include an application component, but a number of different ways. And those are hardware and software firewalls, cloud firewalls. So, basically the way we've oriented our platform is that there is kind of wherever a user is going to be accessing something, we have something that can, I don't prefer to use the term man in the middle because it has a negative connotation.
I know, but
we have a network intercept component, and that's where these things are being deployed. So maybe something delivered via a cloud service from us, and maybe something the customer deploys on premises. Regardless, it's existing tools that over 70,000 organizations have already in place.
Yes,
from Palo Alto Networks. And this is just available and accessible to them as of, I think, August of this year. So that's AI access security. And then the second piece is the two components related to organizations developing their own AI-powered applications or extending their own their existing applications to include AI components. The first one you mentioned, security posture management. So this is an extension of Prisma Cloud, which is our cloud security solution that's been out there for quite some time. So just like anything else, this is protecting against traditional vulnerabilities in the application infrastructure and all the kind of the different application components across the development lifecycle, starting from the developer's IDE all the way to production deployment in the cloud. But then it's also looking at all these AI specific components, going out there and analyzing all these models, hundreds of models, trending toward thousands that we're able to scan and look for things like vulnerabilities, look for inappropriate access permissions in terms of data sets, what's being trained, but basically looking at the provenance of everything that comes into these AI-powered applications as they're being developed. So that's your supply chain security. That's Prisma Cloud AI security posture management. And then the second piece is AI runtime security. So this is extension of our firewall platforms, just like AI access security is. So it's got all of the kind of the traditional threat focused and as well, compliance and similar types of controls that we have for any traditional application. But we've made a huge investment in app model and data protection specific to AI. So we're extending a lot of those things and building new components that are protecting against some of those runtime concerns that I talked about before, and doing so in line, either as a traditional network intercept, like you would have with a firewall, man in the middle, as you put it, or via kind of steering, API steering, right? Where application developer points to us as the API endpoint, and then we point to the model on the back end. And so that's how we get in the path of the traffic between the application of the model or the model and the back end data sets. So a couple of different deployment methods there, one of which is similar to what you would have done with a firewall, one of which is different. The licensing, our software firewall customers, they use the exact same license for this. So it's a different sort of deployment of, let's say, a VM as an example or a container. But it's the same if they already have licensing for this, they can just fire up, deploy one of these in a cloud or in their private clouds. And it's something that should be very familiar to them.
So it is a thing that I'm standing up. In other words, if I want to deliver the AI protections, I need to fire up an instance and to have that service delivered?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. So would I look at this as, like, you guys have this under the umbrella secure AI by design? Are each of these independent things? Like, I could just run AI access security if that's all I need, or am I running all of them, access and runtime, and then the security posture management?
Yeah, they're different use cases, oftentimes, you know, consumed by a different, a different team inside of the organization. They all can be run independently. There's no kind of tie from one to, if you buy one, you don't necessarily have to buy and deploy the other. Our platform components, well, we're pretty, heavy on, trying to push platformization for our customers because it has a lot of operational benefits and efficiency benefits. Everything that we do can be deployed, can be purchased and deployed independently, depending on the use case. Mm-hmm.
And is all of this that we've been talking about, are all of these tools ready today, or has some of this conversation been, forward looking?
Everything that we talked about today is ready today. I mean, it's been a couple of years now since we really recognized this as a big opportunity. On the heels of some of our own early ChatGPT usage that we had to get a handle on inside of the organization. So yeah, we've got a huge teams of developers focused on all three of these products, and they're all available in the market today.
Rich, thank you for a very interesting conversation. So one of the things that happens to Drew and I, we're on a lot of these conversations with folks, and it gets to a point where you kind of think you know the story, and you kind of think you know the answers you're going to get to all the questions. And this is one of those conversations where you told me things I was not expecting you to say. So I appreciate that. It was a great conversation, Rich. If people are listening and maybe they were also educated and want to find out more, where would you recommend they go?
Yeah, well, first of all, I enjoyed the conversation as well, Ethan and Drew. So thanks so much for having me. And hopefully those things that you didn't anticipate for me to say are good things.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you can find us online at paloaltonetworks.com/network-security. Or, of course, follow us on our social channels, X, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. Just search for Palo Alto Networks and you'll find us there.
Yeah, we'll have all those links will be in the show notes. Again, paloaltonetworks.com/network/security or network-security. There you go. And follow them on the socials. They're all there. And thank you for listening to Heavy Networking today. And thanks to Palo Alto Networks for sponsoring this episode. If you do talk to your Palo Alto Networks rep or partner about secure AI by design, would you please let them know that you heard about it on Packet Pushers? We'd really appreciate that. And if you like shows about security, you should also subscribe to Packet Protector from the Packet Pushers. Packet Protector covers security from a networking point of view with your hosts, JJ Manella and Drew Conroy Murray, who you also hear each and every week on this show, Network Break and Tech Bytes. Packet Pushers is also on YouTube. If you'd like to listen to our pods via your YouTube client, you certainly can. Plus, we publish videos, mostly product demos and short courses there as well. Goodbye for now. We'll see you in our newsletters, the community Slack group on LinkedIn, and in our blog. Find all of those 100% free and privacy-respecting resources at packetpushers.net. Until next week, just remember, too much networking would never be enough.